This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer. Today is going to be an amazing show, and I am sure that my galactic space brain is going to be blown by what we are going to be talking about today.
Oh, I'm so excited. So what is the problem that we're solving today?
Where are the aliens?
Where are the aliens? Oh, I can't wait to hear this one. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
So if anybody knows where the aliens are, it may be our guest today. When he is not spending his off-work time being an active science communicator and a strong advocate for more STEM education and research, he works as a research associate at Cornell University, working on modeling exoplanet atmospheres in preparation for the launch of NASA's Webb Space Telescope. Today's guest is Dr. Ryan McDonald.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Ryan.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, we're so excited. So you are by trade an astrophysicist, is that right?
That is indeed correct. I studied physics originally, then I've always been fascinated with space and astronomy. So I thought, well, let's figure out how the universe works by learning physics. And when I know, I can then apply it to figure out what planets elsewhere in our galaxy and universe look like.
Oh my gosh. So do you study all of the planets that are out there in our solar system?
I mainly work on planets orbiting other stars. So we call them exoplanets.
Okay.
If they are so, although the planets in our own solar system fascinated me as a kid, especially Mars. Like I was just, Mars is just the most incredible world ever.
And
like, yeah, it's always had a close place in my heart. The thing that has really excited me is that when I was a kid, we didn't know about that many planets.
Right.
There are just 8 planets in our own solar system.
Yep.
But astronomers have now found 4,000 planets elsewhere in our galaxy so far. And we think there are billions and billions more of them. We're just getting started. And these other planets are so much weirder than anything we have in our own solar system. Like, imagine a world that is so hot that its surface is just molten lava. Imagine a planet that is like Jupiter, but so hot that we get weird clouds of rubies and sapphires, like gemstones that we have on the Earth, but clouds on some of these planets. Like, I mean, when I was a kid, I loved Star Trek and Star Wars.
Oh, yes. And you're with fellow people here.
Oh, yeah. And the planets we're actually finding in the real universe are even weirder than some of the planets that were imagined in these classic sci-fi series. So I feel so fortunate that every day I get to look at the universe and it continues to surprise us. And yeah, we've only just gotten started with this journey.
Oh my gosh.
It just from your super quick description of a couple of them, it sounds like exoplanets are like, if you told a classroom full of kids to make up a space story about other worlds and draw pictures and then do show and tell of what their planets are like, and that's what we're actually finding out there?
Absolutely. It's almost like whatever you can imagine, given that the universe is infinitely large, will be out there somewhere if you travel far enough. We've only just scratched the surface with nearby planets that are a couple hundred light years away from us, which is pretty close on the scale of the universe. And one of the things that is particularly exciting is that in the last few years, we've started to find rocky planets around other stars, planets that maybe are even like the Earth. And some of these planets are the right temperature that they could have oceans on their surface and perhaps even life. One thing that we're all really excited by is that although people have been wondering for thousands of years about whether there could be planets elsewhere in the universe that also have life, we are so close to actually being able to observe rocky planets around other stars and look for signs of alien life. So we will be the first generation that will know that we're not alone in the universe. And that is an incredibly exciting proposition.
That's like really cool. So now this just begs the question that you're going to answer. Where are the aliens? Where do we look? You're looking at all these planets. And how would we know? Like, what are you looking through to see these planets, I guess?
Yeah, so to know if we've found aliens, we perhaps have to think about what life actually is. It sounds deceptively simple because, you know, if you look at a tree, you know it's alive. You look at, you know, a rock, it's not alive. But when, as scientists, we try and think about what actually is life, it's a really tricky problem because we only have one example of life on the planet Earth. So you could, well, when we look at plants and animals, we see that they need to drink water. They need to eat food to provide energy. Right. We move, life has children to carry on.
Right.
And then if you use a microscope and like really peer down into animal and plant cells, we see that we all use this molecule called DNA, which is the secret blueprint of life.
Right.
It is what makes every different type of animal and plants different and distinct from each other. But when we think about aliens, will an alien have DNA? Will they drink water? What will they eat? I mean, it could be completely different. So it's a tricky question to then even realize how we would spot an alien if things could be so different.
When you said deceptively simple for your question of where are the aliens, I am fully understanding that description right there because you are looking and searching for extraterrestrial life somewhere, the quote unquote aliens, but you have to know what you're looking for to know if you found it.
Yeah. So the way that we've developed to try and find aliens, so we all have to breathe. Plants have to breathe. We have to breathe.
Yes.
And there are gases. We breathe out carbon dioxide.
Right.
Plants breathe out oxygen. And it turns out that before plant life arose on the Earth had a completely different set of gases in the air than what we have today.
Right.
So about one-fifth of the air we breathe is oxygen. And that oxygen did not exist before plants emerged. And if all the trees went away and there were no plants on Earth, within a few thousand to millions of years, all the oxygen would be gone. So our clever trick to look for aliens is to look for gases that should not be there. We call them biosignatures because only life, biology, can produce these gases and keep them in the air. So we need to think of what are gases that can't naturally be produced. So a volcano can produce lots of soot and gases, for example. So it can't be volcanic gases. Water, for example, because like oceans can send water into the air.
Right.
So the gases that we normally look for, I mentioned oxygen.
Right.
There is also this gas called methane that is often produced by many different types of animals. In particular, cows are a famous source of methane.
Exactly.
So what we want to do is we want to look for combinations of gases in the atmospheres of planets that can only be there if there is life spewing out these gases into the air.
Jeff and I, our mouths are so big. This is so cool. So now that you explained that, tell me how you find this. Like, are you looking through telescopes? How are you determining the gases of these exoplanets that are millions of miles away?
Yeah, that's a great question. They're probably like trillions of miles away.
Trillions of miles away,
far away. In fact, just to put it in context, the nearest exoplanet is about 50,000 times further away than Mars is. And it takes us 6 months to travel to Mars. Yep, so they are really, really far away.
Wow, that's pretty far. Okay. So then how are you seeing them? What's on it?
So we use a clever technique that we call the transit method to peer into the air of these planets. So what we do is we stare at a star that we know has a planet around, and eventually the planet will pass in front of its star.
Okay.
And when it does, the planet blocks out some of the light from the star. And some of the star's light goes through the atmosphere of the planet. And now we use a technique called spectroscopy. So if you look at a plant, for example, a plant appears to be green when you look at its leaves. And that is because when normal light from the sun, which has all the colors of the rainbow, hits a plant, red colors of light are absorbed by the plant, green is not. And so we just see the light that is left over.
Yep.
So gases do the exact same thing. Gases interact with different colors differently. So the sky is blue, for example, because blue light bounces about in the sky and then spreads in every direction, while red light just goes in pretty much straight lines. When we look at a planet passing in front of its star, some colors of light are absorbed and some colors of light just go straight through. And the colors that are absorbed depend on what gases are in the atmosphere. So we know from measurements in the laboratory on the Earth exactly what the colors of light are that each different gas absorbs at. It's almost like there's a chemical fingerprint
for
every gas. And we know exactly what that fingerprint is. So by looking at distant planets that are many, many light years away with telescopes in space, like the Hubble Space Telescope that I use, we can figure out what gases are in the atmospheres of planets that can be trillions of miles away. And it's remarkable that we can do this.
Wow.
I have to pause before I ask my next question, which will be a real question. But I got to stop everybody. I want you guys to rewind about a minute now. And I just want you to hear the sentence that Dr. Ryan just said, like the Hubble Space Telescope that I use. This man uses the Hubble Space Telescope.
That's cool.
Man, that's cool. Okay, so with the transit method, I understand the transit method, and I have a better understanding of how you're getting that spectroscopy signature from there. Is there any difference in looking at the atmosphere when it's entering the star to block out some of the light versus when it's exiting? Or are you just seeing two different sides of that planet's atmosphere?
That's a fantastic question, actually. You've hit upon a question that is right now at the research frontier, and we don't know the answer to that. I'm writing a paper right now looking at how we might be able to map different regions of a planet's atmosphere using the transit method. So let's write a research paper together.
Like, there you go.
That sounds fantastic.
Okay, so you
I'll
see.
I'll do whatever you want. My name can be way at the bottom.
Okay, so when you see the different gases, you identify them by their colors and so forth. How do you know that there are like gemstones? Are you guessing that this is that they're gemstones, or it's just because the colors come back and match what you think an emerald or a ruby would look like?
So we know that these atmospheres of these planets don't just contain gases, because the signatures that we see of the gases are too weak. There's something obscuring some of the gases. Oh. And it turns out these are clouds. Just like if you look up at the sky on a cloudy day, you can't see the blue sky because the cloud is getting in the way.
Okay.
And I find this to be very amusing, that the arch nemesis of astronomers since the beginning of time has been clouds getting in the way. We finally have launched telescopes into space to get around the clouds.
Yes.
And now the planets we're looking at have clouds.
Have clouds. And you're trying to study the atmosphere.
Don't you wish you could like just blow, get them out of the way?
So we know there are clouds on these planets from the Hubble Space Telescope, but the Hubble Space Telescope isn't able to observe the specific colors of light where rubies and sapphires clouds absorb. So what we've done is we know from experimental laboratory work on the Earth and theoretical calculations at what temperature clouds of rubies should start to form. And by comparing that to the temperatures we measure from the planets, we can make an informed guess that that's what the clouds are made of. So at the moment, we know there are clouds, but we're having to join a few dots to predict what the cloud is made of. Okay. But that will change very, very soon, because we have a new telescope that NASA is developing that will hopefully go up into space in December of this year. It's called the James Webb Space Telescope. Yeah. And this telescope will be able to observe signatures of these ruby clouds. We will have an answer to this question very soon.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so tell us more about the James Webb. Like, how is this? Is this going to be further out in space than the Hubble?
Yeah, so Hubble is in we call it low Earth orbit. It's, I forget, like a couple hundred kilometers above our heads. James Webb is going out much further. James Webb is going beyond the moon. And wow. This has lots of advantages. Firstly, with Hubble, the Earth gets in the way, so you can't look at your planets all the time, while James Webb doesn't have that problem out beyond the moon. So we get twice as much observing time, which is great because we're all desperate to like look at as many planets as we possibly can. James Webb is also bigger than Hubble, so it's far more sensitive. It can collect more light, and it can look at more colors of light than Hubble can. It looks at a region of light that we can't even see with our own eyes called the infrared.
Right.
Like if you've ever used a heat vision camera to then look at how hot like people's bodies are or like buildings are, for example, that is the color range of light that James Webb can look at. And that will hold the secret, we think, not just to looking for ruby and mineral clouds, but also to look for a molecule called ozone, which is an indirect sign of life producing oxygen. So James Webb will be our first window on the universe, our first chance to look for signs of alien life on planets around other stars. And we really don't know what we're going to find because it's never been possible to use a telescope like this before.
That's amazing.
This sounds, because I am the Galactic Space Geek on the show, however you put me to shame, this sounds like the ultimate puzzle that you guys are trying to solve. And some of it seems, after you explain it, some of it seems so obvious of, oh, well, something must be blocking part of the atmosphere. Oh, so there's clouds in that atmosphere. So let's figure out what those clouds are made out of. That is the way you're filling in the missing pieces of the puzzle as technology advances is amazing. So my next question is less relevant. It's more for me, Space Geek Jeff. After the Webb Space Telescope launches, are you then also going to be able to say, hi, I'm Dr. Ryan, and I use the Webb Space Telescope? Are you going to be using the Webb Space Telescope for your research?
So yes, I will. Last year, there was a call put out for astronomers to write proposals to use the James Webb Space Telescope for the first year of observations. And I assembled a team of astronomers to submit a proposal. We have been selected, the program that I wrote.
Congratulations.
So this program, I'm excited about it. So we called the proposal Under the Light of a Dead Star.
Ooh.
So what?
Ooh, that's very good. Very good.
Oh, we love poetry. We love poetry. So
I'm an author. That's a really good hook line.
Wow.
So last year, the first transiting planet around a white dwarf star was discovered. So a white dwarf is what our sun will eventually become billions of years from now. It's essentially the leftover core of a dead star. For a long time, we've not known what will happen to the planets in our own solar system when the sun dies. And of course, we would really like to know that because billions and billions of years from now, it's not happening anytime soon. What will happen to Earth? What will happen to Jupiter? So the discovery of a gas giant about the size of Jupiter, we call this planet WD-1856b. It takes a long time for us to come up with, you know, like more pronounceable names for exoplanets. When we found this planet, it was an enigma. How did a planet survive the death of its star? So I assembled a team and we wrote a proposal to point the James Webb Space Telescope at this planet to measure what gases are in its atmosphere. And we hope to use that to figure out where the planet originally was before the star died, how it survived the death of its star, and maybe tell us something about what will happen to our own planets after the sun dies. So I love it because it's this proposal is right at the intersection of science and poetry, because like this kind of
very
question,
much so.
What will happen? What will happen when the sun dies? And we'll get to scientifically answer part of that question when we get this time in the first year of James Webb observations.
So
congratulations.
Okay.
That's fantastic.
That's amazing. Okay. So when the sun dies, let's see if I can remember my physics. The sun, isn't that usually how the gravity works within the solar system? And so this planet survived the sun dying. Did it move? Is that what you're implying? That it moved somewhere?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So the really weird thing is that this planet at the moment is currently orbiting, way closer than Mercury is to our own sun. It's really, really close.
Way closer.
To its star.
Wow.
It's it's about 2% of the distance that the Earth is orbiting around the sun. So it could not have been there when the star died. Otherwise, it would have been insane.
Right, exactly.
So it must have been hiding in the outer star system. And when the sun became a red giant, it expands and then it kind of whimpers and throws off its outer layers.
Right.
And this planet must have somehow spiraled inwards to where it is today. And we're not entirely sure how it did this.
So the planet is circling around a dead star now.
It is, yep, just the leftover core of a star that once was like our own sun.
Wow.
And do we know if it's still getting closer and eventually falling into the dead star?
It looks like it stopped spiraling in. So it looks like it's just been orbiting for perhaps billions of years, just this leftover sentinel of an ancient star system, just orbiting and orbiting and orbiting.
Wow. You absolutely wrote a terrific proposal.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I'm thrilled that you got it, because this sounds fascinating. And now I want to know more.
Yeah, you'll have to come back on the show once you know the answer to this.
Absolutely. Give us about 2 years or so.
And 2 years or so. So, okay. So I know that like we've had people from the Hubble on before. So can you explain to our listeners, like, what does it mean when you have time? Like you get to point it at what you want for a certain amount of time and then the next science team takes over. So how long of a time do you get?
Firstly, I should clarify that with something as precious as Hubble, I don't get to press the buttons point it at a particular star. There's a whole team of people at the Space Telescope Sciences Institute in Baltimore that are responsible for that. So when we write a proposal, we have to justify what are all the great scientific reasons why we want to look at a particular planet.
Okay.
And what we think we will find to justify why we want to look for, say, 10 hours or 100 hours, we need to carefully show, because it can only look at so many objects.
Yes,
right.
And the time is very valuable. And usually 10 to 20 times more people want time on it than there is available.
Sure.
So we write a proposal, and if it gets accepted, so a whole committee of scientists read all the proposals, rank them, and that's how we decide which science cases are the most exciting. Then once they're accepted, we then work with people at the Space Telescope Sciences Institute to coordinate exactly when it will look at the planet. And they then give us the data. And then we have all the fun of figuring out what the planet is like.
Then you spend the next 2 years deciphering the data and understanding it and processing it. And it's so cool.
So can you say, I don't know if this is a secret thing, can you say how much time your proposal got on the Webb Space Telescope?
Yes. Well, the question is whether I can remember that. I think it was 14 hours, if I remember correctly. Once proposals are accepted, they're all publicly available. So anyone can look up and know exactly which planets we're going to look at with the first year of James Webb observations.
Oh,
we try and be completely transparent about what we're planning to do.
I didn't know that.
Soon as we can get out the results, we'll share them all with everyone around the world.
So if we could understand the results, we could, you know, we could help you process the data. But that's not going to happen.
For me, especially, that is really mind-blowing. And I am super excited for your next year. Not that I want you to Obviously, this was the proposal that you wrote. Is this the type of project that is the most interesting thing for you when you're doing your work?
There are a lot of things that really excite me.
I was going to say, that's a tough question.
Yes.
Probably can't pick one.
Well, to provide one more example that links in with the question that we're discussing today,
about
searching for aliens. So James Webb is going to start to look at rocky planets orbiting stars that are much smaller than our sun. We call them red dwarf stars.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, there's a planetary system that we call the TRAPPIST-1 system that's about 40 light years away. And it's really exciting because it has 7 rocky planets and 3 of them are in the habitable zone around its star. And James Webb is going to look at every planet in that system. And I will be working with a team we have at Cornell on analyzing the spectrum of the planet that is right in the middle of the habitable zone called TRAPPIST-1e.
I know exactly which one you're talking about. I have seen picture a whole lot.
So in the first year of James Webb observations, we're going to be looking at incredibly hot giant planets that we call hot Jupiters. We're going to be looking at a planet around a dead star. We're going to be looking at lava worlds. We're going to be looking at habitable planets, potentially, to see if maybe we can find signatures that they're similar to the planets in our own solar system. That's just all in the first year of observations with James Webb.
And how long do they expect James Webb to be up? I mean, the Hubble's pushing past 30 now. Do they expect the James Webb to be stay in space longer than that?
The minimum guaranteed lifetime is 5 years, but we're all hoping it will last 10 or more years. When Hubble had problems early in its lifetime, we were able to send astronauts up on the space shuttle to fix it. James Webb is going so far out that at the moment, we don't have any rockets that can get astronauts out to fix it. So this is why all the engineers are being so careful with all of the testing for James Webb, because everything has to go perfectly when it launches later this year.
Yes. Oh, that's going to be amazing. Well, Dr. Ryan, this has been so cool. Now, what we want to do, we like to do with all of our shows, is can you give our listeners a challenge so they can learn just maybe a tiny little bit about what you do?
Sure. So my challenge, in all seriousness, is for you to find a planet. So there's a website called Planet Hunters that is a citizen science website. And this website, in less than an hour, will teach you how to use real data to look for planets. And so you might wonder, well, why can't a computer do this? It turns out sometimes computers miss really weird planets, like a planet in a star system with 4 stars was discovered by an ordinary person using this Planet Hunters website. And if you find a planet yourself, you will get to be on the science paper that announces the discovery. So this is a chance for you to look for a planet yourself. And who knows, that planet that you discover could be a planet that has life.
Oh, that's...
Mr. Jeff has a new hobby.
I was going to say,
I'm doing this weekend.
That's a challenge we are going to do. That's really cool. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I mean, it has been so cool listening to all of this amazing science and technology that's happening right now. We will definitely have you back, Dr. Ryan, to find out what happens. But best of luck with all of your first year with James Webb. Wow.
Yes. And Dr. Ryan, as the galactic space geek of this show, I think my favorite thing, even though everything you said blew my mind and is awesome, I think my favorite thing is just how much passion and enthusiasm you have for the work you're doing, and especially the next year and 2 and 3 years worth of work that you have coming. You are exactly the type of person that I want looking for stuff, because I believe you're going to find it.
Yes. Well, so good luck, and thank you so much for being on Solve for Kids.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Ryan.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Okay, Jennifer, this is the first time I'm saying it, but it's a good thing that we have a time limit on the Solve It for Kids podcast, because I could have easily kept talking to Dr. Ryan through meals, through sleeping, through next week.
That was absolutely fascinating. He uses the Hubble. He has one of the first year projects to study with the Webb Space Telescope. And the projects that they're doing are fascinating, trying to find the alien life that's out there.
My mind was blown, just like you said at the beginning of the episode. And wow, to have this job, right?
Like,
yes. How cool would
And he
that
was
be?
So excited about it.
I loved how excited he was. I mean, I just think this is amazing. So, okay. Anyway, listeners, if you are as excited about this episode as we are, then we want you to go out and do these Planet Hunter program that he was talking about. That's so cool. And now you have the ability to go to our website, solveforkids.com, and leave us comments on the website.
On each episode's page.
Right. We would love to hear from you and interact with you. And don't forget that we actually do a book giveaway for each episode. So now if you leave a comment on our website page, then you could be entered to win a book.
That sounds fantastic, Jennifer. I'm so excited that's up. And don't forget, at Kids Solve on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Please continue to reach out to us. We want to make this more interactive, and we definitely want to know if you guys find a planet.
Absolutely. So don't forget to listen next week on
Solve It for Kids.